Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. This is Mike Fader, and we are back here after 2 weeks of replays. One was because it was Memorial Day and there were no live programs, and the other one was because I took a trip to Maine, which was a tremendous ordeal for me. It shouldn't have been. It should have been a vacation. It should have been a break from the city, but it was a kind of an ordeal, and that bears some talking about. You know, all my life, I have had a terrible temper, even a violent temper. And as I've gotten older, there have been times when it mellowed, but now it's come back again in my old age. And I'm beginning to realize what the problem was in terms of my temper. You know, there are manifold reasons for it, but one of them was a kind of lack of control. And I'm glad to say that this may actually be the last, I hope it is the last Skype, I don't know for sure, but I hope it's the last Skype broadcast done from my living room, because this is driving me freaking crazy to do this from my living room, because I'm not sure, I have no control, and what is the reason why it might be the last Skype broadcast, you ask? It's because, remarkably enough, with tremendous hard work and doing a tremendous amount of effort and labor, it appears as if the actual studio, has been built down in a different part of town from where it was originally. But Gary Knowles PRN, Progressive Radio Network studio, and maybe even an extra studio to do extra recording, has been built. And it is now being put together, you know, connected, things are plugged in, things are hung, hopefully not the producers, but things are being set up. And because I would love to not have to do more of these Skype broadcasts in my living room. And that the reason for it is the same reason now, I just thinking about it as I'm talking, is this lack of control that I have here. And it's not just my control over things. And what I mean by lack of control is I can't, you know, see the engineer and can't make hand gestures, don't have personal communication with the engineer except typing. You know, I had the little, can you hear this sound effects? I don't know. I have a little keyboard in front of me and I ask questions by typing, which is difficult for me. I mean, what was it? So Lyndon Johnson said about one of the presidents, he said he couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time. I guess I have that problem. There's a lot of people who do radio these days and have done for many years who look at a monitor in front of them and type things and, you know, actually go on the internet while they're talking into the microphone. I don't have that set of skills. I guess I have to concentrate on one thing at a time. I'm not good at multitasking, although I've done a lot of multitasking in my life. It's usually resulted in disaster. I found out that if I don't concentrate on one thing or even one person at a time, everything gets all mixed up and everything goes awry. Everything goes awry. Not a whole week, it goes awry. You know, like one time I was washing dishes. One time I was running a bath in, I love those old phrases. I was running a bath and it's not a very big apartment, by the way. I live in an extremely small apartment, 2.5 rooms, bedroom, living room, actually 3 rooms and a small kitchen. And I was running a bath in the in the bathroom in the back. And I decided to wash dishes at the same time. This is kind of ridiculous mania. I thought I could, you know, I thought, well, so I covered up the sound of the bath. I thought I could judge the time that the bath was running. And suddenly, as I'm washing dishes in the kitchen, which is about as far away from the bathroom as anything could be in my apartment, which is no more than about 10 paces, I smell this hot, steamy smell, turn off the water. I had the presence of mind to do that, turned off the water in the sink, not that it made any difference, and came in to see a flood. The, the bathtub had overflowed, and it was an inch high in my bedroom. Turned out to be an incredible disaster. I'm on the 6th floor. Water dripped all the way down to the bottom of the building, which happens to be over a couple of stores on Broadway. And the ceiling came down in one of the stores. The apartment below me, the main leak from my bedroom floor, after I, you know, threw towels and coats and everything on it to soak it up, the main leak was on the guy's bed who lived downstairs, right smack on his bed. So he comes home from work, and what does he got? He's got a sopping wet bed. But unbelievably good luck on my part, just pure dumb good luck. Although actually, thanks to my wife's thoughtfulness and farsightedness, of which I have farsightedness, I have none. I'm farsighted with my eyeglasses, but I'm not farsighted in any other way. We had homeowners insurance, and extraordinarily, as opposed to other kinds of insurance that I've come up against and had to use, the homeowners insurance paid for the guy's bed. It paid for the damage to some of the stuff in the store downstairs. It paid for a hotel room for 2 nights while they and it paid for a new floor to be put into the bedroom. Extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. But multitasking is something I've never really been good at, and which is what I would like about a control studio. You know, they say, you know, the control room. That's what it's called, the control room. That's what I like about the studio. And it's not only, I'm just realizing, of course, it's not only that I had control over things. Now, when I'm in a radio studio, I'm eccentric. That's a polite word for what I am. Everybody who does radio has a different way of arranging the studio. And, everybody's a prima donna. Everybody has their way. My way was to clear everything out of my way. In other words, any microphones that had been pointed in my direction pushed away except the one I was using at the moment. And especially as time went on with more and more technology, any computer monitors, I moved them out of the way. I turned everything off except one light and the microphone and me. That way I felt that I could really concentrate on what I was saying. It was almost like shooting an arrow, it's like Zen archery. Everything else for me had to disappear, either metaphorically, figuratively, and literally. I moved all this technological junk out of the way, and it cleared away any wires, anything I didn't need. And in my living room, I mean, I can do that. I put away all kinds of stuff that's on my desk. I move things around. But still, all I have to do is shift my head a little bit, and I see all, memorabilia and other kinds of things. I'm getting a little strange feedback, but I'm used to that. And I hope that these days of broadcasting from home are soon over. I know there are some people who broadcast on Skype regularly over PRN. And I think the main reason is that some of them are actually far away. Some of them are in other states, so they have to broadcast on Skype, I guess. Although I think there are other ways to broadcast, but they're expensive, more expensive, like phone lines that the phone company installs, something like that. But I never realized how much control meant to me before, and the whole idea of a control room. And not only do I not feel in control, not seeing the, not being able to clear away all the junk in front of me, but not being controlled. I'm not in the control room where I'm being controlled. So it's like a two-way thing, and it's all about control. Because you walk into a radio studio, most radio studios, and either it's you and the engineer, or it's you in a booth, or you in the studio by yourself with the engineer on the outside. And there's the walls, there's a door that shuts, there's soundproofing, which I don't have here in my apartment. Well, you can't hear anything, because I don't think this microphone picks that much up. But there are sirens outside, and there are people talking, and there are people walking up and down the hallways. Now, I can probably hear all this, but probably you can't, because this microphone is such a dinky little microphone. And I don't think it's very sensitive at all. It doesn't pick up a whole lot of stuff. But I am realizing now that I'm still in a kind of a state of anxiety and depression over what happened to me a year and a half ago after the emergency heart surgery I had, from which I almost departed this mortal coil. And there have been a lot of losses since then, physical losses. All kinds of things were affected in my body when they did this surgery. One was one of my vocal cords got nicked, which is something that will never be very much different. And although I can sound, clear enough or strong enough, my voice, for about, 45 minutes or an hour sometimes. And most of the times it's hoarse, and I have to do all kinds of exercises for it. But even then, there's a limit to it. Also, all kinds of things. I went from being 68 to about 102 in terms of my body. And all kinds of things that were, I suppose, hovering that were going to happen anyhow. Now, did I abuse my body that much? Did I eat a lot of junk in my life? Not really. Well, but I did when I was young. Like everybody else in their 20s, I had malteds and fries and burgers for lunch. I shouldn't say everybody else. I'm sure these days, perhaps. But back when I was 25, which was around, 1970, when I was 25 in 1970, the general understanding or acceptance of eating healthy food and organic stuff was for a very, very small minority of people. It was not something that was very well known and very well accepted, and not even that much available. I grew up eating Wonder Bread. Wonder Bread. Does Wonder Bread still exist? I wonder if Wonder Bread still exists. Wonder Bread was the worst bread ever made. I don't even know how much bread was actually in it. It was a wonder that they even got away with calling it bread. But it was what everybody ate when I grew up in the 50s in my neighborhood. It's what you had, your peanut butter and jelly. It's every sandwich is on Wonder Bread, bologna, peanut butter and jelly. And I think Wonder Bread had a slogan that said, build strong. But are you wondering if I'm going to get to the point of anything? There is no point to this. There's no point today at all. There may be a point if I feel like making it. I don't know. But I haven't been on for 2 weeks, so I'm liable to babble a little bit. I haven't been on live, I should say, for 2 weeks. And I know you miss me because of the thousands of emails I got from people saying, what happened, Mike? Where are you? And I appreciate that. I do appreciate that. If you want to get in touch with me, by the way, for any reason, as long as you're nice, as long as you're polite and pleasant to me, because I would cry otherwise. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, just go to my website. It's called Feder Files, FederFiles.com, FederFiles.com. And there should be a way there, if it's working, to contact me, to send me an email, and I will hear from you then. But in the last 1.5 years life-threatening open heart surgery, emergency open heart surgery, I have gotten all kinds of physical conditions, which, as I say, may have been lurking around anyhow and shown up in the next few years in any case. But they all just decided to blossom like blooms in the spring. And so now I'm taking all kinds of – now, I do try to take as many cures and remedies as I can. And I certainly don't eat a bad diet. In fact, my diet is extremely good. It's only because I'm lazy that I don't cook better, but my diet is pretty good. There's hardly any meat or anything else in it. But and for the last 10 years, I haven't eaten wheat, I haven't eaten meat that much. But in any case, so everything is – so now I'm taking lots of different kinds of pills. And inevitably what happened to me is I went back – because I was off the radio for several months. I lost my radio show at Sirius, which I had, and I was off PRN for 6 months after this operation. So I sat around here, and because I was so weak and because of all these other physical conditions I developed during that time, I just basically sat inside my apartment. I was dizzy when I went outside, and inevitably, because this has happened to me many times before in my life, I went back into my default position. My default position was a kind of depressed isolation alternating with terrible anxiety. And this is how I grew up. And I got into a state, which I am still struggling with, of a kind of rigid need for control of everything, so that everything overwhelmed me. Getting into this kind of isolation and depression and staying inside the apartment because I'm afraid to go out that much. Even walk around a block is threatening to me sometimes. And I get into a kind of feeling of control because I grew up, as I've mentioned, an incredibly large number of times, too many times. I grew up in a madhouse. I grew up like literally in a madhouse where all kinds of insanity was going on downstairs outside of my room. And the only way I could maintain my sanity was to stay in my room. Couldn't go downstairs. It was like descending into some alligator-filled swamp, right? So I stayed in my room and with a loony mother and a missing father. And I used sheer willpower. I just vanished into my own head and used sheer willpower, just stayed in a sort of a dark bedroom and just didn't move. And, of course, what happens is the more you do that, the worse you get because you don't go outside. You don't fraternize with other people. You don't have friends. So I've always been kind of isolated and scared of the world and afraid. And now I've wound up back in that same position. And I always found that I always had this feeling of trying to be in control, because everything in my house, at least outside my room when I was a kid, was out of control. I mean, really out of control. And so I had to maintain some kind of control over myself without any help. So I stayed in the room, which seemed safe. You know, it had four walls and a ceiling and a floor. And I just rigidly maintained control of my body and my mind to keep my sanity. And now I find myself in that same position, in a kind of crazy, isolated depression, which I spend every day trying to punch my way out of. You know, what's that old phrase? Guy can't punch his way out of a paper bag. That's a funny old phrase, isn't it? Presumably, I guess a paper bag is easy to punch your way out of. But every day I wake up, there was something from this great TV show, Deadwood. Raise your hand. Did you see Deadwood? It's a great show. It's a great TV series. If you've never seen Deadwood, check it out. It's grim, and it can be kind of violent, but it's just brilliant, profound drama, really great stuff. And there is one of the characters is, there's a, you know, buff, who is it? Wild Bill Hickok is one of the characters. And one of the characters, of course, is Calamity Jane. Calamity Jane, who knew Wild Bill Hickok. Calamity Jane was a total drunk. You're supposed to say alcoholic? She was a total drunk. And one time she passed out on the floor of some hotel or rooming house, and she gets up all befuddled and confused about life, and you know, she really didn't have any control of her own life very much, either mentally or emotionally. And she gets up and she says, I think I'm paraphrasing it. She says, every day takes learning how to live all over again. And that's the spot I've been in for quite some time now. So I have to get back in the world. And it's all about control. And I keep thinking, the more control I have, the better I'm going to feel. Well, it'll be nice to be in a control room again. You know, hopefully it'll be set up by next week or the week after. And, you know, God bless Gary Null and everybody else that worked so hard, including our program director and all the other people that worked hard to set this studio up to see how it works. I haven't even been down there yet. But this rigidity and this control is something that I feel like I have to exert all the time. It's like a default position in my life. When I'm talking in this way, I mean, how many people would talk like this for so long? Well, you can only hope that it's entertaining, or that it reminds you of something in your own life, and ultimately maybe you could get something out of it. If you don't get a laugh sometimes, although I haven't been that funny lately, you might get some inspiration. This has happened with people over the years. But I had a tendency to talk like this even in my personal life. And it's a way of exerting control. It's a defensive move. When people talk too much, and I know some people, and we all know people who talk too much, right? I go through periods where I don't say anything at all, of course. Sure sign of a neurotic. When somebody alternates between not talking at all and then suddenly talking too much. But, you know, we all know people who talk too much, and it's a defense. It's a defense system to keep from being overwhelmed by somebody else. That somebody's ego is so fragile, and I'm sure enough it's true in my case, it's so fragile that you have to keep talking all the time to keep their ego from, as you imagine, you know, their words and their ego from just penetrating right through any kind of border that you have to your own personality. It's a method of controlling the world. And the irony is, of course, the tighter you hold on, the worse things are. It throws you off. The more you try to control things, the more you're disconnected from life, because life is about as much as life is much more about not having control than being in control. It is about pain and loss and suffering and mortality and a whole world. And we all try our best, right? Politically, we try to help our friends. We try to help our family. But so much is out of control. And if you don't learn that, which I've never really quite learned, you always imagine that you could control things. I could control my environment. I can control whether I'm going to be sick or the weather, even anything. It's grandiose beyond belief. And in The Snow Leopard by Peter Matheson, which if you've never read, you should definitely read The Snow Leopard, a wonderful, wonderful book. It can be tedious in spots because it's about a journey. It's about a journey, and sometimes he gets way into the scientific details of the journey, but he needs to. But it's much more about spirituality. And Peter Matheson, who died recently, last few months, was very much a Buddhist, practicing Buddhist. That's some water. Control my throat. Well, Peter Matheson was hiking in the Himalayas, way up, 10,000, 12,000 feet above ground. And on these narrow, icy mountain paths where there was hardly any room. And I think it was in Nepal. And the Nepalese guides he had, they were perfectly loose, totally loose. They would walk on these paths as if he said, that they were just walking on a sidewalk someplace. Whereas the people he was guiding who weren't used to this would be rigid with fear and try to control everything. And their muscles would tense up and they would hold on to the mountain as they tried to walk. And those are the people sometimes who would fall. And the Nepalese had a phrase for these people. It was called holding on too tight to the mountain. A phrase for this behavior called holding on too tight to the mountain, which I have always remembered because that's what you try to do when you're afraid. And these days, sadly enough, I live in a kind of state of fear a lot because of what happened to me suddenly, physically. And then being in isolation took me back to this place where I was afraid a lot when I was a kid. And what you try to do is you hold on tight. And the tighter you hold on to try to control things or not have anything change around you, which is impossible, of course. But you don't know that when you're scared. You think, do you ever have that feeling like when you were so scared that you just grip, you make your hands into fists and your body becomes rigid and you don't want to move at all? And you think if you don't move, it's almost like an ostrich hiding under the sand, that nothing will happen to you. Well, of course, the great irony is that the more control you think you have and the more control you try to exert and the more control you try to have around you and the more control you want people to have over you so that you're in one rigid position, the worse you get because you are disconnected from the looseness and the change and the spontaneity and the movement of life and eternity. But, that's something like Calamity Jane said, every day takes learning how to live all over again, at least for me in this spot. I mean, I've been in looser spots in my life, and I hope to be in a looser spot again. But now I'm back in that other spot, and it's tough. It's tough. But I want to tell you about a little bit about my trip to Maine. Let's go to some music first. Well, they sure get the point across in that song. You can feel it, right? That's how I feel. I'm laughing, but I'm crying on the inside, like Pagliacci, you know. But yeah, that's how it feels. That buzzing, crazy, electric anxiety, and feeling like things are out of control. Feeling like things are out of control, and they're not out of control. Well, I mean, the world, especially if you live in New York City. You can easily get the feeling that things, and I specifically mean Manhattan, you can easily get the feeling that things are out of control. And if you read the newspaper or, whatever, if you look at the news or you read about the news, however you get your news, you certainly see like the world seems like it's out of control. The weather, wars everywhere, things are out of control. But Maine, I went up to Maine, and I've been up to Maine before under much better circumstances when I was feeling better. Maine is a really, really beautiful place. Maine is an absolutely beautiful place. It's a combination of woods and water. It borders on the ocean. And most of my wife's family lives in Maine. And the reason for the trip was my wife's nephew's graduation from college. So she was going up there. And I just didn't feel like staying alone back home. And I've done that before when I was more solid, but I decided I'd go up there. And to be with her, also, let her go up there by herself, it wouldn't be such a nice thing. So I went up to Maine, and this is the first time I've taken any kind of trip whatsoever longer than a 20-minute cab ride in Manhattan for about a year and a half since I had my surgery. And as I say, sometimes it scares me to even walk a couple of blocks on the Upper West Side. And I have to keep pushing myself to do it. So this is a 400-mile trip to about two-thirds of the way up the coast of Maine. And I've been there before. Over 20 years, I've been there like 15, 16 times in the summer when it is absolutely beautiful up there. So we get out on the highway, and I have to realize that things are out of my control. I can't drive. And it's been a long time since I could drive because I have vertigo. So I know how it sounds. I know. Imagine how it feels. But I have vertigo, so I can't drive. I don't even sit in the front seat of the car, which is unfair to my wife, of course. But I have to sit in the back seat. If I sit in the front seat of the car, the onrushing traffic sets off the vertigo. So yes, I know. Anyhow, so I sit, so right away, things are not under my control. I don't have all my little control items around. I'm not in my apartment, not in my little room. I don't have my favorite chair. I don't have the computer. I don't have my TV set up exactly the way it's supposed to be. I don't have all my little OCD things surrounding me and all my pills in the right place. Everything is moved and changed, and you have to be flexible. And I guess I've never been that flexible. It's on a continuum. During the most, I suppose, emotionally healthy parts of my life, I've always been very spontaneous and flexible. So we're missing this, we go find it somewhere, or we make up the difference somehow, right? No big deal. But when you get rigid and unique and you're in this situation where you feel like you have to control everything. So here I am, she's driving, and she likes to drive anyhow. Fortunately, she really likes to drive. She likes, I suppose, to be in control herself, right? She's always a nervous passenger. Even when I was driving, up until a few years ago, she didn't even like it. She would backseat drive, even though she was sitting in the front seat. So finally, we agreed that she would drive. So she's driving, and she knows the way. 400 miles, right? So I'm sitting in the back seat. Right away, I'm not in control of anything, right? I'm out of my little control room and in this moving car going, 60, 65 miles an hour. We're both conservative that way, so we're always in the right-hand lane generally. And you're on the highway. It's strange to be on the highway when you haven't really been anywhere for a long time. And I know a lot of people who are listening travel a lot. And I know most people do take vacations and travel a lot. And up until, like about 2 years ago, I did that regularly too. But we're out there, and it seems like we're going really fast. But I think that has something to do with age. You know, it's like the old people are always driving in the right-hand lane and old people drive slow. Well, you know, my wife's not as old as I am, but still, you know, there's a kind of a conservatism and a fear and a need for control when you're older that you don't have when you're young. When you're young, you have strength and agility, and your mind is more flexible, and you're able to jump from one thing to another. Now, I know people my own age and older who certainly have that too. So, you know, it doesn't work that way for everybody. But we're on a highway, and of course, you know, if we drove the whole thing in one gulp, it would be, it's 400 miles, it would be like 8 straight hours on the road. Well, I mean, you take a break for lunch and bathroom breaks or whatever. But what we usually do is, since it's so much driving, we usually go halfway, which was what we did on the way up, and stay overnight in a hotel and get up and do the next 4 hours and finish the trip. And we did that. And of course, when you're driving on the highway, you're going, you know, pretty fast. But there are the rest stops. There are all these service stops and rest stops. And the service stops remind you where you are. You know, if you're in this car and you're zooming along, because it's strange to go 400 miles, even if you drove it in 8 hours, and we drove 8 hours straight back. It's strange. And of course, it's much worse if you take, it's much more strange, I should say, if you take a plane somewhere. I haven't been on a plane for, I don't know, 10, 12 years. I haven't been on an airplane. But the idea of driving, on the way back, we drove 8 straight hours. To go from a place which is so different. Maine is so green and quiet and beautiful, and the air smells fresh and clean. And the people, there's not that many people there. It's like a whole different world from New York City. And of course, if you take a plane, it would be even more strange and more unsettling and disconcerting if you take an airplane. If you take a plane or you travel to some place that's really foreign, the one place I travel that is the most foreign is Istanbul. I went to Istanbul once, and where everybody looks completely different. They're speaking a language you don't understand one word of it. They have completely different customs. Usually, sort of in some ways nicer. They're nicer to each other, oddly enough. You know, the Middle East has this reputation, but the people in Istanbul were the most helpful, kind people in a way, especially to strangers. I don't know how it is now, but it was that way back in the 70s when I went there. What I'm trying to say is that to go so far in such a short period of time, and even 8 hours, is a short period of time to go 400 miles to a completely different place. You have, like I say, an unsettling feeling. And we only went up there for a few days for the graduation and to stick around. And there were parties and there were dinners and things we went to. But then you're walking around in Maine, and it's an absolutely beautiful place. The house where her sister lives is right on the water. It's right on the water. So what you do, and it's surrounded by woods, though. So there, these beautiful woods, mostly pine woods and other kinds of trees. It comes almost right down to the water, and then there's this big long lawn, this green lawn, and there's this small harbor. It's where there are sailboats and lobster boats that are buoyed out in the, you know, they're moored out in the harbor. Using the right nautical terms, I'll salute. And it's quiet, and it's a whole different feeling, right? And then to be there only a couple of days and come back, how odd it is. And I remember the times that I've taken trips to faraway places, even if they were in this country, but if they were very different climate. And Istanbul was a much warmer climate, although it generally is somewhat the same as New York. It may be on the same, what is it? Longitude is New York, but it was warmer, it was hotter there, and it was sunnier than it had been in New York. And I think I went sometime in the spring. And you stay there for a few days. When you get back from a place that's so different, and especially if people are speaking a different language or there are different customs, or if the topography, if the geography is different, if it's desert, if it's tropical, if it's someplace like Maine, which is so lush with green trees and the beautiful salt smell of the ocean there, right down there. You come back from this place, the first week or 2 weeks that you get back into the city, back into Manhattan, it's like you had a dream. It's like you're possessed, like you're enchanted by some kind of dream. And the journey, the destination, it's as if modern life was, we go so fast, it's as if modern life was like a series of destinations with this time in between, which you have to get someplace really quickly, where you have to figure out what to do during the time in between, unless you're a seasoned traveler and you don't mind taking a lot of time to get somewhere. But people have appointments, they have meetings, you know, the graduation in this case was at a certain time, and then we had to be back at a certain time because we both had to go back to work and go back to doing, and I had to go back to doing whatever it was I do. Don't work as much as I used to. But there's this feeling of displacement, of displacement, where you're in one completely different kind of climate and among different kinds of people with a different aura and a different cultural feeling, usually, generally, depending on where you go, but compared to Manhattan, much slower and much friendlier and simpler. So there's this kind of strange feeling, and I'm thinking probably back in the day, although it was so arduous and difficult and dangerous, the way people used to travel back in the 19th century, you know, on trains and before trains, they traveled in wagons and horses to get to a destination where people can go to now. You could go someplace in 4 hours or 6 hours that it used to take people 6 months to a year to get to. And there's a difference. There's a vast difference to that. The idea, and then what happens, I think, is that each place is an experience on its own. And it takes so long to get someplace that you don't feel that feeling of displacement. You know, I mean, nobody would want to go back to a time when it was all that arduous, dangerous, traveling where anything could happen. But the advantage, I think, probably was that the slower that you go someplace, the slower it takes for you to get somewhere, the better you really are in terms of actually experiencing life itself. That it isn't a series of when are we going to get here? It's like a kid said, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? You're always there. Wherever you are, you are. And people, I think, had that naturally. They felt that naturally when they were traveling in a slower way. And, you know, you get to Maine, and it's absolutely beautiful up there. Unfortunately, it was raining the whole time, drizzling and very foggy and kind of cold. Apparently, Maine, the only time that it's really warm and sunny is in mid-June through the end of August. But it's a really cold place otherwise. And we got there at the end of May, and it was still very cold, and unfortunately it was raining. I was looking forward to some nice long walks, you know, through the woods and along the seashore, but we couldn't do it. But our hotel had this beautiful view of the harbor, so you just open, you know, you just open the shades in the morning, or you keep open if you, you know, nobody's going to look in, and you look out on the harbor. And there's woods beyond, you know, on the other side of the harbor. And there's the lobster boats. And there's the sound of the waves breaking fairly gently on the rocks. And everything up there is changeable. You may not notice that, you know, the weather changes in New York, of course. But you don't notice the change as much. And you don't see the weather. But up there, the weather is such an overwhelming thing. I mean, the sky is vast. And the weather becomes something that's like a force. It's like a third person. It's like a second person. You take a walk, and the weather is walking with you. It's with you. It's just an overwhelming situation. And everything there, where we were, there's a lot of old houses. Her family lives in old houses that have been fixed up. although one of her relatives has a fairly brand new house, but still they live in the woods and they live next to the woods and they live near the ocean and everything is up and down, right? In New York City, it gets so used to walking in a flat, you know, walking on flat sidewalks where everything's on a grid and everything's flat. You don't really, there aren't that many hills to climb and everything is sort of even and everything is measured and everything has right angles and everything is like balanced, right? But there in Maine, you have to get used to a whole different way of your body relating to the earth and to the woods and to the world around you. The weather is always changing, you know, if you're near the ocean. So there's always fog coming in and then it stops and then the sun comes out for a little while. And then you see clouds, storms in the distance. Then the wind comes and then it dies down and you could feel it all. There's no buildings in the way. You see the sky, you see the weather, you feel the weather. And the best thing about it is it's quiet and it's green. And it's very, very relaxing, very relaxing. But you do have to get used to, you have to, it's interesting enough, you sort of have to give up control. You have to give up control of things. And it's a good place to do it. Now, I do need, instead of to try to control things more all the time, I need to give up control, which is the hardest thing to do because you fear what will fill that vacuum if you give up control. You feel it's almost like a feeling of imminent death if you give up control. As long as you're holding on too tight to the mountain, you're okay. But of course, you're not okay. And you go to a place like Maine, and that's the reason why I never get on a boat. I've always been down near the ocean, and the ocean always scared me because I've been on boats out on the ocean, out on Long Island where I grew up. And my father used to take me fishing out on the ocean, sometimes in rowboats near the shore, and sometimes we went on fishing boats. And I never liked being on boats. I don't like being on something that's in an element where you can't see what's underneath. The water, especially the ocean, always scared the living crap out of me. Because of my need for control, I didn't like the fact that the boat was going back and forth all the time. I didn't like the fact that there are things swimming around under there that I can't see. I didn't like the element. I didn't like the element. And I think people who are at home on the sea, at home in the ocean, on the ocean, at home in boats, probably have a much more laid back, much more flexible, balanced view or feeling about life itself. They don't worry about control as much. They don't worry about control. And they're able to live their lives without that feeling of a need for control or to control other people or other, you know, other things happening. And there are suddenly storms, you know, in a place like this. In New York City and Manhattan, if there is a sudden downpour, you know, you duck into a store, whatever. You're in your, you know, you're in your apartment building, whatever. There's always some place to go, right? There's always some place to go. But when you're out on the weather, when you're out on a boat and you're in a storm, or when you're walking through the woods and you're in a storm, there's really not a whole lot of shelter. There's not much shelter at all. And you get what shelter you can, but you have to give up control. And like I say, even the old houses that a lot of these people live in, we stayed in a hotel that is really sort of a remade old house, a guest house that is very large. I think it was once a Quaker meeting house. And they renovated the place, and it's all slanted. It's like all these old houses, they're slanted. The steps are slightly slanted. The floor, the planking on the floor, it's an old house. The walls are a little, you know, slanted. You know, it's not like some kind of fun house. It's not like Alice in Wonderland. But it's not like an apartment building. It's not like sidewalks. Everything is a little tilted, and you have to get used to being flexible. You have to give up control. So it was tough for me the whole time, only I was beginning to like it. I was beginning to like the feeling of not having utter control over everything, or I should say not having the need for control, because you don't have control. You don't. But not having to have the need for control was in itself a kind of a vacation for me. It was like a vacation. And also, we had to go to all kinds of, you know, to graduation. I spent a lot of time by myself. I had to go to all kinds of big parties and dinner parties and where people were talking. And I hate parties. I've always hated parties and crowds because I don't feel like I have control over things. I feel like everybody's voice is like, you know, jabbing right into my ears. I feel like people's personalities are kind of like walking into mine. So I always feel better when I am with one other person or maybe one or two other people and things are relatively quiet. I don't like crowded restaurants. I don't like museums. I don't like big department stores. So I was thrown in, you know, to all these parties too. And, you know, I had to do what I had to do. You know, I had to associate with other human beings. What a horrible fate. What a horrible fate. And although it was difficult for me, I'm sure it was very good. But up there, I noticed that lately, I have to say, and this is going to upset some people who have been listening to me for a long time, I have been praying. And I can't say I'm praying to some anthropomorphic God. I'm not praying to some particular anthropomorphic God or some particular version, some religious version of God, one religion or another. But I am praying a lot these days. I think it's an extension of the kind of meditation I do, this Buddhist meditation, where you just let your mind wander and the only control you exert is a kind of lack of control. You give up control, trying to control your thoughts. You just let them wander in and wander out of your head. And lately I have been praying, I guess, I pray to God, but I think it's like praying to, like very much like Buddhist meditation, praying to my better self, praying to my better self. And at one point, right before we were supposed to leave, we were going to get picked up to be driven back home. I'm standing there with this luggage that we had and looking out the door of this old building we were staying in. And I was praying to God, you know, whoever God is, my best self, let's say. That's who I'm praying to, but I call it God. And I'm saying, please bring me some peace. It's been a long, hard year and a half. Please bring me some peace. And just as I said it, a beautiful dove, a morning dove, flew down and landed about 2 feet away from me on the other side of the glass. And I didn't want to move or grab my camera or anything because I was afraid I would scare it away. Just landed there. It was this beautiful dove with white feathers and gray feathers and black specks on it and some brown and tan feathers. And it was clearly feminine. It was so feminine and it was utterly peaceful. You could just feel that it is the symbol of peace, the symbol of peace. I had asked for peace and this thing just sat there and looked right at me for several minutes and only flew away because somebody arrived to come and get the luggage and for us to get a ride back. But it was absolutely fascinating that I was praying for peace, and a feeling that I didn't have to control everything every minute again. And there's this dove that landed and looked right at me the whole time. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And I'm trying to carry that with me as time goes on. I'll see you next week.
In times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be. Let it be. night is cloudy, there is still a light that shines on me. Shine until tomorrow, let it be. I wake up to the sound.